Welcome to From Our Lips to Your Ears, the Local Immigration Partnership Podcast. This is a podcast about newcomers to Canada. My name is Damilola Unime. I'm going to have frank and open conversations with people who have made the journey of settling in Canada. In many ways, these people I'll be speaking with are living examples of successful newcomer settlement. But the purpose of these conversations is not simply to tell success stories. And neither is it to celebrate newcomer resilience. Although the newcomers I'll be speaking with certainly are resilient. They have to be. The point of this podcast is the settlement process demands extraordinary resilience on the part of newcomers. But does it have to be this way? Should immigrants need to be this resilient? What do stories of newcomer resilience tell us about how Canada's settlement system can and should do better? So I'm going to speak to newcomers about the challenges they are facing and the things they've learned along the way. And then we're going to think together about what needs to be done so that immigrants and refugees can rely more on Canada and less on their own resiliency and strength. Along the way, we'll also encounter local immigration partnerships. Most people call these organizations LIPs. So when you hear LIP, that's what I mean. Local immigration partnerships. LIPs do collaborative work at the community level, so that whole communities can help alleviate the need for newcomers to be so resilient on their own. Somebody is there to help. And often, it is other newcomers. In this episode, we're going to bring you three stories of resilient newcomers. Roberto Montiel, Reem Fayed, and Daniela Fernandez. But we're going to recast these stories a bit. We're going to read their resilience as ways the settlement system has fallen short. Reem Fayed settled in Moncton, New Brunswick, and we're going to talk to her about jobs. Reem eventually landed a good one, but it was tough at the start, tougher than it should have been. Daniela Fernandez settled in Fredericton, New Brunswick with her mum. Her mum came here as an economic migrant. They had a job, but that's not all you need. Daniela's family needed a community. But first, we're going to talk about the racism that newcomers face, sometimes out in the open. But Roberto Montiel tells us, often it's more subtle. It even comes from well-meaning people. If you didn't know much about Canada, you might just think of it as a kinder, gentler sort of America. There are some overtly anti-immigration groups here, but usually it isn't so loud. Canada is often thought of as friendly to newcomers. Remember when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau welcomed Syrian refugees with those winter jackets? But newcomers, they still face racism. Once somebody screamed at me, go back to your country. But other times, it's subtle. They'll give you condescending advice all the time. Or ask you questions that make you seem exotic. There's a lot of racism here. It's just that it's often racism with a smiling face. That's what Roberto Montiel quickly discovered when he arrived in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Coming from what he describes as a privileged family, Roberto is a Mexican exile turned lead of the Halifax LIP. I reached out to learn how well-meaning people can perpetuate racism and colonialism, even people who support migrants. But first, we start at the beginning of his own settlement journey.
When I visited Canada, I always thought on the possibility of moving here. I really, really, really liked Canada in the few days I was visiting.
Would you say that the experience of migrating here, living in exile, would you say now in retrospect, was that born out of naivety?
Out of being young.
Did you come to that realization or that conclusion because, you know, you were expecting a safety net in Canada and that safety net was a stark contrast to the reality that you were dealt?
Yeah, although that was much more gradual. Understanding the deeper face of Canada in relation to immigrants and specifically in relation to non-white immigrants, it took me a long time. One of the reasons why I loved Canada when I was visiting, I was in the biggest cities. My sense was the sense that, I mean, Canada has been selling all over the world and it does it very well. There's a wonderful place for diversity, that it welcomes everybody, that it is a multicultural mosaic. And as a visitor, I had that experience. The pain of exile, I think that it's not only Canada, and I cannot blame that onto Canada. Knowing the pain that goes behind that, is I would definitely not make that decision again. It was very difficult to see at the beginning. And actually, at the beginning, I thought that Canada was, that Halifax specifically was a really friendly place, that we were feeling welcomed and supported. Certainly, there were people along the way that were almost like heaven sent, that were wonderful and were supportive. And without them, I would not have been able to study a PhD. I would not have been able to get here. As I got deeper and deeper into making this place my home, and I got my relationships with people here started to go deeper, that's when I started to see that other face of Canada that's not so easy to see. That is the face of systemic discrimination, colonialism. I find the Atlantic very parochial. It is very friendly, but it is also very parochial. They give you advice no matter what about everything. Some of it comes from kindness and care, but some of it comes also from this we know better perspective. And also, I think that friendliness at the beginning, it was so new. For me, it took me a while to see, oh, yeah, no, that there's the friendliest racism that you can find in Canada is here in the Atlantic, but it is super racist. Yet maybe after a few years being here, I started to understand. And I cannot say it was disappointing or anything, but it made my journey to really call this place my home way longer. It took me many years for me to feel that I really belonged in this place.
You said something about, you know, experiencing systemic discrimination and the discrimination that comes with being a non-white immigrant, right? How did you deal with the experience of, you know, being a BIPOC individual in the Atlantic? Also, you know, having been born in a privileged family.
That's the thing. I think that my privilege galvanized me from many of the experiences that I faced here. I have my ignorance as my biggest blessing at the beginning. When I was being othered, I thought that I was being othered in a cool way. I thought, oh, it's because they think that I'm very cool. Like they think my accent is cool. Or they would tell me things that would exoticize me and I would think that that was a good thing at the beginning. It took me a long time to actually see the intentions behind. Because now there's this thing about like, there's almost like a toolkit about what not to say to immigrants. And it's like, don't ask an immigrant, where are they from? It's like, well, no, actually, when it comes from a good place, you can notice. When it's coming from a place of curiosity, it's actually very good. And it's a lovely conversation starter. When it's coming from a place of othering, it's problematic. But making those distinctions took me a long time. And after I started seeing, oh, no, I am being exoticized in a very bad way. My accent is being weaponized against me. My previous experience is not being taken into consideration. I am considered a person who has way less knowledge or way less experience than I have because they are not counting my experience, they are not counting my knowledge, but all those things were unfolding in ways that I at first I did not notice. And I think that because I didn't notice, it seemed like I was a very agreeable and a very enthusiastic go-getter.
Was there a particular incident that was like the light bulb moment for you?
I think that, yeah, when I started working in this job and I started seeing that happening in different ways to many of the immigrants I was working with and many of the folks I was working with, that's when I started noticing. For many years here, I did not see myself as a BIPOC individual. I learned that I was a person of color here. And you mentioned coming from privilege in Mexico. When you come from privilege in Mexico, you're raised as though you were white, and no one tells you that you are not. You're Mexican, but you're kind of a white Mexican. And that's kind of what the thing that you travel around. When I start seeing these things that were being done on me onto other people, that I started noticing, oh no, these things that were done onto me were really bad. It was just that I did not register those things. Now I consider it to be a blessing, but it was very painful for many years, was the fact that in Mexico, one of the things that I loved the most was teaching. And that's what I was doing there. And here I have not taught one class. I have guest lectured many times, but I have not been able to teach. I stopped trying a long time ago, also because university and academia is not something that now interests me. But when it did, it was a big source of pain. I didn't understand why I was not given the chance to teach. So yeah, that when I started seeing that happening to other people for reasons that were similar to reasons that were given to me, it was like, oh no, this is not something that I can fix.
It's an experience that a lot of immigrants, you know, would face, not being able to get credentialed, not finding a job. You have to continuously be resilient. In your personal experience, and of course your professional experience working with the LEAP and, you know, other organizations that you have worked with, what do you think it is about the settlement journey in Canada that requires and calls for continuous resiliency on the parts of immigrants? And what do you think that says about the settlement process?
I would say three things about that. The first one is that I would point out that most of the people working the settlement sector who are in senior leadership positions are white people who do not have the immigrant experience. That's a very important thing to keep in mind as to how the settlement sector imagine integration. A second thing is, I think that the narrative of resiliency came with the ships a long time ago. That's a narrative that comes with colonialism, but it comes with the big pride that settlers put on their families when they arrived. As my family, when they arrived, they had to go through so much and they survived all this and then they thrived. That is a narrative that seems to be perpetuated over and over again. So, and then the third thing that I would say about the success stories is it is coming with good intentions. I think that that's why I was trying to make that second point. It's like, yeah, that it is kind of in folks, it is in their own ancestry. It is in their own narrative that the success of few people can inspire a larger group of people. But unwittingly, it is putting people down. Unwittingly, those stories put people down. Unwittingly, those stories of resiliency are asking people, all that pain that you have, all that suffering that you have, is actually something that you have to go through. It's a prerequisite to get to this place, and it is good. In my view, my pain, my suffering, yeah, they had shaped me and they have been formative, and I now embrace it. But I think that nobody would be in the position to tell me anything about my pain and would tell me, oh, it is your pain that is like, no. I would rather not have that pain. I would rather not have had that suffering. I didn't choose this.
But the Canadian government invests a lot of money into the, settlement sector. But the challenges, still persist. They haven't gone anywhere. What are some of the factors that you think are impeding the improvement that we all, of course, want to see in this sector?
One is the fact that the mandates are so constraining. The journey of settlement and integration is not a journey to belonging. Only until very recently did the Canadian government start talking about immigration in terms of belonging. It is still not rooted in belonging, because belonging would mean something way larger than learn the language, be proficient in the language, and find a job, which are basically the two biggest things that summer integration does. The other thing that I would say that right now it is very raw in my work, the fact that, as I was pointing out, most of the people who are making decisions around settlement are people who do not have an immigrant experience. And I think that that definitely affects the way in which it is shaped, and it continues to be shaped. Having the immigrant experience and having many different immigrant experiences often would shape very different approaches to what it means to belong, what it means to be to make a home. But because that is not something that is so close to heart to Canada as a nation state, Canada celebrates as a nation state the fact that people can be moving around for careers over and over again, particularly if you're young, go explore, move around. Making a home is not something that seems to resonate that strongly with the culture here. So the folks who are shaping that are coming with that narrative. It's very problematic. And I don't see the settlement and integration sector doing much around those issues.
And on the topic of programs that would be helpful to newcomers, let's talk about the work that you do with the Halifax LIP. What programs or initiatives are you involved with that helps to address some of the persistent challenges in the settlement process?
Out of two that I can think of that I am very proud because of the process, some community circles that we have between very newly arrived immigrants and Mi'kmaq people here. The first time that we did that, it was beautiful, and it came with many different beautiful things and connection, which was what we wanted. We wanted connection, and that happened. Another one that I can still living within me is a family reunification forum that we did. And that family reunification forum we did with folks who were separated from their families and didn't know whether they were going to be seeing their families again. And they shaped that forum. It was not us. It was not a panel of experts or of service providers. We just allowed the platform. We just opened the platform for them. But they were the ones who decided what it was going to look like and what was going to happen. And I still feel it was a meaningful thing. With COVID, most of my work went on a desk and bureaucracy. And that's when the realization hit me that my work has been strengthening the oppressive structures that supposedly I want to at least make flexible, if not tear apart. At least I would love those structures to be much more flexible. And I think that my work has been strengthening those structures at large.
And what are some of those mistakes that the LIP has or is still making that is strengthening these oppressive structures?
Most of my work has gone to things that teach them how to be Canadian and how to be Haligonian, which is that colonial approach, that approach to colonize people's hearts and minds so that they start behaving in ways that are going to be conducive to their success here. And my work has participated in that narrative. What I'm trying to do right now, widen the conversation, broaden the conversation to other groups, look for points in which we can build solidarity between immigrants and other groups, looking at issues much more holistically and less short-sightedly, like we have a housing crisis here. I'm still infuriated that some people call it an emergency. It is not an emergency. It is a crisis. It has been a crisis for years. Eventually, it's going to hit immigrants. And the short-sightedness of this is out of our mandate, I think, is terrible. Once we come back to community, start doing things like those I was pointing at that are shaped by the people who are the recipients of those things and not by us. So that's another thing that I am determined to keep doing.
And who are the key players in making the necessary changes to address these challenges?
There's community, which you always have. And as long as there's community, those are the key players. Now, there's, of course, the gatekeepers. If your question is about the gatekeepers, well, the gatekeepers are those senior leadership folks that I was speaking about, and those are everywhere. Those are in municipal government, they are in provincial government, and they are in the settlement sector. The settlement sector is also very, very deeply entrenched in provincial and federal practices, because most of their funding are coming from the federal government and from the provincial government. So in a way, even though they advocate and even though their heart is in the right place and they're lovely people, amazing people working there, incredible people working there, systemically, they're very much company to the federal government and to the provincial government. So those are the gatekeepers, and we'll see if they are more willing to change things. That has been my question mark every day that I go to work.
That was Roberto Montiel. He is the lead for the Halifax Local Immigration Partnership. Reem Fayyad's early experience as a newcomer to Canada would be familiar to many. Despite having held high-profile positions before arriving in Canada, she couldn't find work in her field when she got here. Actually, for a while, Reem couldn't find a job at all. So while she was looking for work, she wanted to pursue education, something that would help her find another kind of job. But as you hear, her work permit wouldn't even let her enroll in classes. That's just how the system is set up. Work wasn't working out for Reem, and school wasn't either. But today, Reem does have a good job. She's the Executive Director of Performance and Measurement with the New Brunswick Health Council. But I wanted to talk to her about the initial barriers she faced and how she worked to make Canada eventually feel like home. I started by asking Reem about her first few months in Moncton, New Brunswick.
Like all immigrants, I guess when they come to Canada, the first thing they get to experience is the cold and the winter, which is very common, commonly reported. It was the same for me. Besides that, I would say that I had positive and negative kind of surprises or shocks. So I was really very much pleasantly surprised by the community in Moncton and the people, how friendly the society was. The perceptions in the Middle East, usually about countries in the West, as we call them, is that it's cold, it's not very friendly. People are like very much into their own personal lives. So seeing this kind of hospitality or like friendliness in the community, and especially that Moncton is a small city, it's not a very big city, busting and very busy life. So it was very, very pleasant surprise for me. I was definitely happy and had a good expectation, and it was met in terms of safety and stability. And that's something that we could easily see in Canada and in Moncton, and the quality of life and nature. All of these were kind of very good expectations that were very well met. On the negative side, I would say, or like the expectations that I had that were not properly met, I would say the job market for me was one. Before I moved here, many people told me because of my job and or my profession in the environment sector, that it would be easy to find a job, knowing how Canada is a green city, green country, and like with lots of interest in that domain. Being in Moncton, which was not the city where the government sector lies, it's not the capital of New Brunswick from a government perspective, it wasn't easy for me to find a matching job in the environment field per se in Moncton. So that a little bit delayed my my sense of professional integration in the city.
Even though you were very extensively educated, you had worked, you know, in high profile positions previously before migrating to Canada, how long did it take you to get a job in your field?
It took me a year and a couple of months. One of the limitations, I guess, that I faced when I moved here was the fact I came on an open work permit. My husband had been here on a work permit because he had a job offer. So I joined on an open work permit. This makes it easier for you to find if you want to find a job, obviously, because it's a work permit. But because it wasn't easy to find a job, I couldn't use the time to, let's say, enroll in education if I want to do something to complement the experience to push me in the job market easily. My first language is Arabic. My second language is English. French, I had basic knowledge of French. New Brunswick is a big on bilingualism because it's a very strong component here. 30% of the population is Francophone. Basically that meant that I had to invest some time also to build my fluency in French, to make sure that I can actually be, to find the job that I wanted.
In that 1 year, what were you doing? You were trying to learn French. What did you do, you know, to prepare yourself for the dream job that you were trying to find?
It was a year full of roller coasters, I would say, because I went from coming in with the high hopes of finding a job quickly. I immediately realized that it's not easy, given the circumstances. I tried to do a lot of my homework in terms of researching the opportunities here. So I explored the different organizations that could match my profile. I tried to take initiative sending my resumes to different places, rather than just wait for to see vacancies that are matching. It kind of got me more aware of what's available around the city. So that was a key platform to start from. It equipped me to know where the opportunities exist. I used the time to get to know the city and the community a little bit. At that time, the first year, it was a little bit limited because most of my network was the friends who are also from the Lebanese community that kind of wrap around you to help you integrate. And it was a very strong component that helped me actually get over the first year. Being a person who had always been employed since I got since I graduated, it was hard for me to feel that I'm unemployed and dependent financially. So the social component kind of compensated for that feeling. But I tried to make use of the time to address all of the opportunities that could exist. Language training was important. And at some point in time when I was like on one of those lows in the roller coaster, I even started to contemplate changing my career before finding the job I found, which was a perfect match. But so it's normal to go through those ups and downs, like in this, before you find what you actually want to do.
In the settlement world, we often hear of success stories. You know, you can argue that you are one of the successes. You got a job in 1 year. It's kind of unheard of. You know, it can be very challenging for many immigrants who have just come into this country to find something in their exact line of work. So we often hear of the success stories that most times hinges on the resiliency of newcomers as they try to adjust to their life here. In your experience, what is it about the settling process in Canada that calls for continuous resiliency on the part of immigrants?
Traditionally, I think, and conventionally, before the huge boom in immigration and settlement agencies and groups like LIP, immigrants were kind of dealt with as kind of numbers. So let's say we know we have a target of how many immigrants we want to attract or to retain, or a percentage of retention and so on. But what the LIP and other groups are started, and there's a long way to go, obviously, it's to understand the uniqueness of immigrants as they come and how different their experiences are. And they are individuals and that not numbers. So depending on the conditions of their immigration, depending on where they're coming from, their background, where they're settling, all of that can make them have different, complete different experiences and complete different expectations. And if we don't understand the different needs, it's going to be hard to have a cookie cutter approach to everyone. I personally feel that an immigrant per se, just when they make a decision to move from a certain to an uncertain, they have that resiliency in them. Like regardless of anything, they do have that. I call it as a seed of resilience in them. It's very unique. It varies from one person to the other. And it, by itself, it's not enough. So you can have the resilience if you don't have the right environment around it. That resilience by itself is not enough. Settlement agencies and groups like the LIP obviously bring this component of wrapping around that seed of resilience in the immigrants. And the more they understand how unique the experiences of immigrants are, the more successful they are in helping them integrate in any place that they are in.
What does it say about the settlement journey or the settlement process here with the fact that the Canadian government invests so much money in the industry or the sector, but you know, these challenges still persist?
It goes back to the fact that we're still not there when it comes to understanding the different realities. Services are important, and services are definitely very key to help immigrants settle. It gives them a sense that, let's say, if you need language training, you can get it. If you need housing, you can be helped to navigate and find your way. What's missing, I think, and needs to be stronger is the human interaction with the community, with the host community where the person is coming to. I see from different settlement agencies that the immigrant goes to the office to, let's say, enroll in a certain course or to be linked to a certain health provider or like to the school. But are they getting the connection they need to get within this community and to feel that human interaction, which is very key for me personally? And when I mentioned that when I found my job, it was a key game changer for me. Not only the job that was the game changer, it's how I felt the colleagues, the interaction with colleagues who are Canadian, who are not immigrants. It changed my perspective. It helped me get more integrated. So it's not just about getting a service. It's about also creating opportunities for immigrants to actually communicate and connect with other citizens, some of whom could be immigrants. And there are so many multicultural events that settlement agencies organize for immigrants to interact and have an exchange. But it's this connection with the host community that is important, I believe.
Who is responsible for addressing these problems? The settlement agencies, the government, the community, the immigrants themselves?
It is a shared responsibility. It's not a one-way kind of a responsibility. There are multiple factors, like there are people around the table that have to all invest time and effort to do that. So from the perspective of the government needs to establish the right resources and investment to enable those kind of opportunities to happen. Settlement agencies need to have a good understanding of the immigrants that are coming to their communities. What are their different realities and needs? If I'm a skilled worker immigrating, or a business owner or a refugee, I might have different realities. If I'm an international student coming with no family, it's different from having a family. So understanding the needs is important. The different government bodies outside the settlement sector and immigration sector are also important, like health and education and social services. LIP is providing this networking opportunity for all of these to discuss the realities. But also, immigrants themselves need to also put some effort and to be more proactive in how they approach the host community. And not to just assume that I'm coming here and all services have to be made available for me to integrate. I need also to invest the time and to do my homework, to be proactive, to reach out, to volunteer, to network. It's only that can basically help everyone get to where we want to get. Yeah.
Let's talk a little about your time with the Lib.
When I first came to Moncton, one of the things I joined at the time, or the activities or the associations I joined, was the Lebanese Association. Obviously, coming from a Lebanese origin, the group was very active in the community with lots of activities. And when LIP started, it needed obviously people around the table. One of the representations was ethnocultural associations. So. We were one of the associations invited to join, and I was representing the association around the LIP. At the time as well, I was wearing kind of two hats, not only the immigrant ethnocultural background. My job equipped me also to provide insights from a perspective of data and statistics about immigrants. My job in the Health Council, I had a lot of... knowledge and information about surveys and stats about immigrants in the community and in New Brunswick. So I made sure to kind of contribute to the discussions using that kind of information. So a lot of discussions where I felt I was adding value were around bringing these two hats together and helping the group understand the needs of the youth, immigrant youth, and immigrants in general in the community.
That was Rim Fayad. She is an executive director of performance and measurement with the New Brunswick Health Council. Canada needs immigrants. Canada wants skilled workers. This isn't news to anyone who has been listening. In fact, the Canadian government has set up multiple entry streams for interested people to migrate here. But when they arrive, what happens to them? Daniela Fernandez and her family moved from Colombia to rural New Brunswick when she was 13. They wanted to build a community there. But other Colombians, mostly, they just came, they worked, and they left. So today, Daniela wants to change that. She's a community outreach worker with 211 New Brunswick at the United Way. She's trying to help newcomers make a home of New Brunswick and find their own community. I started by asking Daniela what it was like back when she arrived at 13 years old.
It was definitely a really interesting transition, very big contrast between the place where I was born and the place that I immigrated to. So I'm originally from Medellin, Colombia, which is the second largest city in the country, a city of 4 million people. And we moved to Florenceville, New Brunswick, which is a small town of about 2,000 people in a rural area. So everything about it was completely different. And of course, I think at that age, you know, I was sort of just starting to kind of open up my world and make friends outside of school and sort of finding my own way. And so then to suddenly be kind of uprooted and transplanted into a new place where we kind of had to learn everything from scratch was definitely a big process. You know, not only learning the language and the culture, but also just, you know, ways of life and living through the seasons and adapting to a whole new climate. That definitely came with its challenges.
When your mom told you, hey, Daniela, we're moving to Canada, what did you imagine it would be like?
I didn't want to come at the beginning. My mom even gave me the option of staying back in Colombia, but I obviously didn't think that that was going to be a realistic option for us. Like, I didn't want her to make the journey on her own. And I knew, of course, that there would be lots of opportunities for me to learn and for us to travel and just kind of expand our worldview. But it was hard to accept at the time. What did I imagine? Well, to tell you the truth, I don't think either one of us, my mom and I, really knew that much about Canada. She told me she had this pamphlet that was like probably 5 to 10 years old at the time when she considered going to Canada. And it was kind of like just a really quick overview of, you know, the typical like northern landscapes and snow-covered forests and all this stuff. And so she imagined a place that was really peaceful, which appealed to her because after living you know, for decades in a really big city, like bustling modern city, she kind of wanted a bit of a change. For me, it was the opposite. I think I was hoping that it would be kind of like what you see in American movies, which is kind of terrible. But I mean, I think I just pictured this like idyllic sort of like suburban looking neighborhood where all the houses sort of look the same and everyone's got a manicured lawn and like a little cul-de-sac where all the kids play and ride their bikes on the street. And it wasn't really like that. Parts of certain towns can be like, can kind of have that more sort of cohesive feel to them. But rural New Brunswick isn't really like that. We sort of showed up in the middle of February, which is a really tough time to immigrate, of course, because of the winter. And we were surrounded by potato fields and farms, and houses were very far, like spread out amongst themselves. And so even connecting with neighbors wasn't necessarily always easy. So yeah, I think I imagined that there would be a bit more of like a community hub and that the community would be a bit more dense and easy to walk around and stuff. But that really wasn't the case.
How did you deal with being the one, like being one of the few persons or people of color in this very white community?
I mean, well, my situation is obviously a little different because, I mean, as much as I am Latina, like my ethnicity is different, but I am a white Latina. So really, I kind of pass in most spaces, which I think made it less challenging for me to make that transition. But of course, culturally speaking, like everything was pretty much new. It was really interesting for me that there had been a number of families from Latin America that had immigrated to Florenceville 5 and 10 years before we actually arrived, simply because the company that hired my mom had a policy of hiring a lot of workers from Latin America. And so we weren't the first ones. We weren't the only ones. But interestingly enough, as part of the arrangement, when people get hired through this company, they're asked to stay on with the company for at least 5 years in order to pay back some of the costs of moving and relocating us to Florenceville. And a lot of those families had kind of completed their 5 years and sort of left to go to larger urban centers like Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal, Calgary. So I ended up being one of the first young immigrants that made it to high school. Like other immigrants had sort of stayed for elementary and middle school years, and then they had moved on. And so by the time I showed up to high school, which, as you may know, high schools here are kind of like a congregation of all the other like rural schools, like all the kids from different areas end up sort of going into the same kind of collective high school. So suddenly, like people from very, very small communities that had never really had an opportunity to interact with newcomers or learn about other cultures, well, they were meeting people like me in high school. So that was interesting because I think I was faced with a lot of questions that for the most part were really innocent, like just people being curious about where I'm from, where I come from, what I'm all about, what our life is like back home. But also questions that, you know, came out of left field that surprised me, that kind of reinforced that a lot of what people knew about my home country specifically was a lot of stereotypes and a lot of negative portrayals of our culture based on news and the media. So that was not entirely surprising, but definitely something that I feel like I have to constantly kind of face and correct people about and speak more positively about my own culture and my own country just to change the perspective of these youth that were kind of running into people from different cultures for their first time ever.
So would you say you had the support that you need dealing with all of this?
In some ways, yes. I think our experience as economic migrants was actually quite privileged, to be honest. I mean, you know, it's been 17 years almost since we migrated here. And looking back on other people's experiences that I've met through the years, we had a lot of support. It was my mom's company that paid for all of our moving expenses and our relocation. At the very beginning, they had housing that was provided to us for the first couple of months while my mom found a house for us. They were even kind enough to, you know, go to the school with me. Like I remember sitting at the principal's office in my high school with the HR manager at the corporation where my mom works, because they were that invested in helping to make sure that parents knew how to enroll their kids in school, that the kids knew how to choose their classes. I was even given a private English tutor that the school was paying for, I believe. So it was a retired English teacher that would coach me in the mornings on ESL, basically, so that I could catch up. And then the following year, I would take regular classes with all my peers as expected. And I remember even in our specific town in Florenceville, like there wasn't a multicultural association or a settlement association at the time. So the closest multicultural association, which was about 30 minutes away, they actually started offering kind of like satellite services to help support the spouses of other people who had been hired by the same company so that they could also learn English as a second language and build community and make connections, because there wasn't really anything like that at the time. So I do think that we had a lot of support. But in terms of dealing with these kind of cultural differences and navigating those dialogues and having those conversations, that was kind of very much on us. Like At the time, I don't remember ever hearing of anything like cross-cultural competency workshops or cultural diversity workshops, this and that. That was not a topic at the time. But yeah, I would say we did have a lot of logistical support when we first arrived. Otherwise, I think there's been a lot of self-learning and discovery, I think, that's been kind of evolving since then.
Would you say, because of your experience, that's what informed your path?
Personally, I've always ended up working with international students or newcomers, I've done a lot of work in experiential education and international exchange programs, like trying to foster safer spaces where dialogue can happen, because I do think that that's hugely important. Like I definitely think that my personal experience informed that path, like in terms of wanting to bring people together to create more understanding and more harmony and to break down barriers, break down stereotypes. So yeah, that's probably why, you know, part of the motivation why I've ended up doing a lot of the work that I've done in the past. And I've even worked as an employment counselor for newcomers in a different life, where, you know, my hope was to help people to make this transition more easily and to also work with employers to educate them on some of the barriers and some of the main challenges that newcomers face, so that they would also be aware of the ways in which they could facilitate that transition and create more welcoming workplaces for people that were choosing to move here to make their new home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd say those barriers that you're talking about are what in this sector causes the journey of settling in Canada to hinge on resilience of the newcomer. In your experience and, the work that you've done professionally, what is it about the settlement sector in Canada that calls for continuous resiliency on the part of newcomers?
So many aspects. On a personal aspect, like just dealing with the loss and the grief that comes with leaving your home and your roots and your family behind, you have to be really resilient to not give in to that and the isolation and the loneliness that can set in when you first arrive and you have very little community or no connections to speak of. That takes a lot of resilience to be able to make it through. Also, just constantly, you know, for especially for racialized minorities, I do think that it takes a lot more resilience to be able to assert their presence and their value and their merit and their contribution in certain spaces that have generally been more reserved for, I guess, the white majority, so to speak. So that also takes a lot of resilience, just constantly having to sort of revalidate and reaffirm your own experience or explain to others what your experience is like, despite the fact that they may not be able to relate to your experience personally. I don't necessarily want to affirm this, but I just know that it's a reality. I think so many people as the ones that perhaps choose to pursue this opportunity or that have this opportunity to migrate, there's so much pressure from their families, from their home communities, from their families, from their parents to, you know, perform and please and perfect and produce. Like they have to be the success story, quote unquote, of their family, because they're the ones that sort of have this great opportunity to make something with their life. And so I do think that that creates a lot of pressures on newcomers to just work harder, faster, better, constantly work, to constantly put out an image that everything's fine, everything's great, like I can keep up with the Joneses. And so that of course then creates another environment where you have to be resilient enough to know, okay, when to put yourself first and your own priorities first, where to set boundaries, how to take care of yourself. I mean, I think the fact that resilience has to be there implies that moving through the system is really challenging. If that's something that you constantly have to muster and renew and refresh every time so that you can keep going through all the hoops and all the challenges, that also speaks as to how the system is built and where there are barriers that could be removed or at least made lighter for different people. The system could stand to take a look at some of its own structures and practices and ask itself, you know, are some of these barriers necessary? What is the reason why some of these barriers exist? Who does this affect? Can we change any of this process to make it easier for everybody? So, you know, for example, like the fact that we have such a lack in medical professionals in some parts of the country, like here in New Brunswick, that's a reality. And yet there's so many barriers for trained medical professionals from other countries to actually start their practice here. Like it's years and years of studying, of testing, of doing practicums or unpaid internships, then writing exams that cost hundreds of dollars, if not more. So there's so many different aspects of the system. Like it's a huge industry, of course, the resettlement process and all the agencies and aspects that are kind of attached to that. So I do think that there's opportunities to review how those structures currently function and why it is that they demand so much resiliency on the part of people that are choosing these opportunities. If Canada really so needs this talent and these families and this economic kind of like stimulation for local regions, then we have to make it easier for people to actually make that choice and actually settle here. Otherwise, we're asking people to uproot their lives, to give up their careers, to, you know, bring up all of their life savings. And then if we don't create an environment where they can actually thrive, everyone loses.
Let's talk a little about your work with United Way and, you know, the work that you did with the LEAP previously. I know that you are involved in an initiative called IOBA at United Way. Tell me about it.
Sure. So IOBA Moncton is the city's newest cultural club, is what we like to call it. It's an initiative that's meant to fill a gap in services and social supports for international students, more specifically. A lot of the local settlement agencies often receive funding support to serve permanent residents and refugees, who are also technically permanent residents. But oftentimes they don't receive funding specifically to offer programs and services to international students. And so there was always kind of this crack that all international students would continue to fall through. And in regions like New Brunswick, where we're hoping to attract but also retain newcomers, initiatives like this are vital. So IOBA basically hosts and organizes social networking activities once a month, open to anybody. Again, newcomers, international students, friends, local allies. And the idea is just exactly that, just to expose people to the range of opportunities and friendships and connections that they can make so that they're able to feel more at home in their new community.
That was Daniela Fernandez. Daniela is the Director of Community Engagement for 211 New Brunswick at the United Way of Greater Moncton and Southeastern New Brunswick. And that's it for this episode of From Our Lips to Your Ears, the Local Immigration Partnership Podcast. I have been your host, Damilola Unime. I'm also the series lead producer. From Our Lips to Your Ears is produced with the National Local Immigration Partnership Secretariat. From Our Lips to Your Ears is made possible through funding from Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Canada. It's also made possible by continued collaboration between local immigration partnerships across the country. This has been a Cited Media production. For more community-partnered and research communication podcasts, visit citedmedia.ca. Thanks again for listening and check out our second episode. It's about the relationships between newcomers and Indigenous peoples on this land. It's out now. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.